All right, let's do this. Peanut, if you're staying in the room, no talking. Hello, and welcome to the PhotoWork Podcast, the talky and touchy-feely version of my book, PhotoWork, 40 Photographers on Process and Practice. Hello, everyone. I'm Sasha Wolf. I'm recording from my echoey new recording studio, but we will address that. And so apologies if things don't sound great today.
Well, you have your echoey studio. I might have a buzzing sound from the army of leaf blowers in my neighborhood.
Okay. Well, audio quality confirmed, yeah. Going downhill. Well, that's my guy there, everyone, Mr. Michael Chauvin-Dalton. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Hi there. Yeah, congratulations. Hi. You're in.
I'm in. Yeah, it's super exciting, and I'm also just so relieved to be at the end of renovation, well, the end of negotiation, mortgage, headaches, and unpacking. I think I know where most things are now, although it took me couple hours to find my checkbook yesterday, but
do you know where the corkscrew is?
Mr. Priorities. I think I do. Yeah, it's been a lot. And just so folks can sort of, if you are so inclined to picture this space, I got this 1930s cottage in Woodstock, and it has this, I don't have acres, but I have this like sort of enormous backyard that's fantastic and really beautiful. Person who lived here before did incredible plantings. So they're just these gorgeous trees, young trees.
Oh, what a great time of year it's been for you to move.
Yeah, it's really been beautiful, and just tons of flowers are coming up. And there's an outbuilding that's pretty big that I've turned into my office, and it's really wonderful building, insulated. I did put an electrical panel in here. And then the next phase is you coming up to build out a little recording space.
Phase Chauvin-Dalton.
Exactly. That's exactly right. I'm so glad that you recognize. yeah, Faye Chauvin-Dalton is you coming up and helping me build out a little recording space within my office, because as people can hear, it's, you know, I'm not complaining that it's a nice big space, but it's very echoey and whatnot as is. Anyway, also today's show is another one of your shows, because I have been really underwater. And so we'll get to that in a second. But I do just want to say that next episode, the one after this, I'll be back in the host chair. And we have five or six really fantastic guests lined up to take us through the summer. So really, really excited to get back to my gig.
That's right, everyone. Take a deep breath. Sasha will be back next episode.
But thank you so much for being so generous and offering the PhotoWork Podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah.
Really, really appreciate it. So why don't you tell us about today's show?
Yes. So today you'll be listening to Ben Brody. And Ben and I recorded at the Chico Review. And so a lot of my recordings coming up will be from Chico. And Ben is a veteran from the Army. He had signed up when we were invading Iraq to be a photographer. And he very quickly became disillusioned with the way his work was being censored and edited and what was being released. And he made it his mission to produce two books which deal with that censorship, also with his own participation in this propaganda machine. And those two books are Attention Service Member and 300 Meters. And they're very unique books and really interesting books. And Ben was so generous sharing his personal experiences and the guilt he felt and the way he's reckoning with that guilt.
Ben is a lovely person who I also had an opportunity to meet and spend a little time with at Chico, and I'm so glad that you had the chance to talk with him and that we get to share that
on our podcast here. A little side note. Ben was the first person I sat down with at Chico. And, you know, with all the logistics of lining everything up, I was very excited to have my first guest. And maybe, I don't know, I feel like I was over exuberant. I have a lot of interjections in this recording. Not interruptions, just interjections. I usually try to stay very quiet when on mic, but there's a lot of yes and in this episode from me.
Is this your disclaimer?
Yes, this is my disclaimer.
I can so relate to wanting to share a disclaimer. Oh my gosh. Yep. I feel you.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure it's a great episode and people will really enjoy it. So any other announcements?
Well, of course. I mean, we should note that you have a new recording studio and a new home. Our relationship with CPW is certainly not going away. I think we have a lot of plans in the works with them. And of course, with our sponsor, Picture House in the Small Dark Room, I don't have a list of events coming up, but you should always keep them in mind for their lab services, their post-production services. And we are going to be recording live there with Raheem Fortune in the near future, let's say.
Yeah, we're trying to nail down that date. Raheem is super busy because he's doing a lot of press, a lot of events for his new book, Hard Tack, Everyone Buy the Book.
Published by Loose Joints. I just picked mine up. I just got it signed by Raheem. Yes.
Ah, very nice. Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful book. So Raheem is going to be in conversation with me at Picture House in the Small Dark Room. As I said, we're just trying to nail that date down. We'll let you know once we know, but it's going to be either the end of May or the beginning of June. So that's going to be really fun. So, you know, come to the event. And also, it will be on the podcast.
Exactly.
All right. Well, why don't we get to it then, Michael? If you don't mind, please take it away.
My pleasure. And here is my conversation with Ben Brody. Well, hi, Ben. Thanks for taking time out of all of our busy schedules at Chico here to do this.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Michael.
Yeah, this is great. I'm so happy to be recording face-to-face.
Yeah.
Well, you said you've done some shows as well, but all remotely, right?
Every podcast I've ever done has been over Zoom.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I'm like in my house with my mug. Everything's nice. I don't have any equipment in front of me that I'm unfamiliar with. Yeah, it's a different thing.
Exactly. So why don't you just talk a little bit. I know a good deal about your background from reading about it, but you definitely have a more unique entry into photography through the military. But before we get to that point, did you come from a military family?
No. My grandfather, who died before I was born, was a chaplain during World War II.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, when I announced my intention to join the military to my family, you know, they thought I had completely lost my marbles.
What?
Yeah.
what did your folks do?
Well, there was nothing they could really do.
No, I'm sorry. What do they do for a living, work, occupation?
Yeah. So my father was a real estate attorney. And my mother worked in healthcare administration. But being like in a secular Jewish family north of Boston, the military was not
on anyone's mind.
Yeah,
right?
Not sort of top of everyone's hopes and dreams for their firstborn son.
And were you on any other trajectory before that?
I mean, really just photography.
Yeah, but, so that's what I wanted to get to, too.
All, you know, young, aspiring photographers, I had no idea, like, what a job in photography really meant. And so, you know, this is the late 90s when I'm coming up in photography, like in high school. And then for a few years after, and I thought, well, you know, maybe if I point my 4x5 at beautiful landscapes and make big prints, people will pay me lots of money for them.
That's right.
Turned out to be not a thing.
Did you have an Ansel Adams calendar?
Yeah. I mean, I had all three of the books, you know, the camera, the negative, and the print.
Did you have that in high school?
Yeah.
Oh, so, I mean, you're your kind of knowledge at a high school level was pretty good then, right? I don't know many high schoolers who had those books. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I really threw myself into photography really seriously. I mean, it was the first thing I was good at.
Oh, wow. And was there a strong program at your high school?
No.
Oh, wow.
There was just a basic photography class. The professor was really a ceramics guy, taught photography
on the
side.
The art professor, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
But I just, it's not rocket science to like learn it yourself.
No, right.
And I think a lot of young people are attracted to, the equipment and the mm-hmm. gear and the process, like particularly with analog processes.
Sure.
Which I've definitely seen coming back.
Yeah.
You see 20-year-olds are around on the street. They're all carrying like Pentax K1000s and Canon AE-1s. It's great to see.
I just ordered a bunch of AE-1s for my program.
Yeah.
Just to replenish it. Yeah.
I'm a K1000 man, but I get it.
Yeah. So is it right out of high school that you joined the Army?
No, I spent a couple of years just kind of messing around. Mm-hmm. I was doing a lot of photography on my own, but supporting myself being a furniture mover. And I put myself through an unaccredited photography program in Boston, a now defunct school called the New England School of Photography.
Oh, okay.
But I worked with some amazing people there, mm-hmm. like David Akiba, who's like a pretty legendary Boston photographer, art photographer, David Herwalt, documentary photographer. So I had a good grounding in photography by the time I joined the military mm-hmm. when I was 22, but I just had no experience in photojournalism, which would comprise the bulk of my career.
So it's kind of a confluence of things. You were already interested and trained in photography when you did enlist, and that was because we were invading Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of people my age, my parents' generation was the generation that fought in Vietnam, mm-hmm. not my parents specifically.
Yeah.
So you were always sort of surrounded by the media and the culture, the movies, the photo books. I grew up like looking at Larry Burroughs' work. Yeah, and I just felt, reading like Hunter Thompson books and, new journalism and everything that was happening in the 60s and 70s was very like attractive to teenagers in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So when it became clear that the U.S. was invading Iraq under obviously false pretenses, I felt like this could be the main story of my generation in the way that the Vietnam War was the main story of my parents' generation at that time. And the only way I knew to go and see it and photograph it and witness it was to join the military because mm-hmm. I didn't have any money to do it on my own.
Right.
I didn't have any connections or experience to where I could get a news organization to sign off on
me. You'd have to be backed by news organization. In fact, that was something in the Bush era that was instituted that you were not allowed to sort of go freelance at that point. Wasn't there to keep photographers embedded?
Yeah. Right? So during the invasion, there was sort of a group of photojournalists who were not embedded who managed mm-hmm. to cover it. Like my mentor, Gary Knight, was one of them. But as the war, sort of became more intimate and more personal, mm-hmm. it would be impossible to cover what the military was doing without an embed. I mean, there are obviously lots of other things you could do during the height of the war in Iraq or Afghanistan mm-hmm. without a military embed, but covering the U.S. military was not one of them.
And what is that part of the, I don't know, if is it a core call that you end up joining as a photographer, right? Mm-hmm. What's that title? What's that?
My title was combat camera, I think they call
really?
It.
Really?
Yeah, but that's, even that is like a sort of a slang. I'm not sure what it was.
Yeah.
You're part of a very small number of soldiers or Marines or sailors or mm-hmm. who are tasked with photographing combat operations. And I got, quote unquote lucky and spent half my time in the Army photographing combat operations in Iraq, which is what I wanted to do.
Right.
If I had known how easily I could have just been, through a clerical error, stationed at a base in Kansas that does not deploy and just waxing floors for 5 years, I never would have joined. But, but my ignorance and luck, you know, that's how I assembled like the body of work from Iraq that I came out of the military with.
I mean, you still go to the basic training. You're still a soldier, right?
Oh, yeah. You're armed. You're trained. I mean, my first tour, I was with soldiers who I had trained with for 18 months before I got to Iraq. So yeah, we could all fight as a team.
Right.
Yeah. My second tour, I was more of sort of traveling photographer, you know, is more similar to like what I did as a civilian in Afghanistan.
Yeah. And so, yeah, you're there and you're making photos and then you start to witness or experience what is the censorship and propaganda element of working for the military as a photographer, right?
Sure. Yeah. The military does not have photographers because they feel like the American public has a right to know the unvarnished truth about the prosecution of the global war on terror. And, you know, the same goes for civilian media. Like they don't embed civilian media because they feel like the American public has a right to know. They embed media and have photographers as a way of, you know, utilizing information warfare effectively in a visual sense. So that sort of cognitive dissonance between, you know, being sort of instructed as to how I was supposed to represent the war versus how I actually observed the war, you know, was definitely the genesis of some deeply felt agita. And ultimately, you know, what resolved into 7 years in Afghanistan as a civilian post-military and the book Attention Service Member.
Yeah, wait, 7 years in Afghanistan after what?
So I left the military in 2008, you know, after my contract was up.
Okay.
And then I went to Afghanistan as a civilian, photographing there for, I didn't live there for 7 years continuously, but I photographed seven fighting seasons, which are each, you know, 6-7 months long.
And then in what capacity were you there photographing as a civilian? Were you represented? Were you part of an organization?
No, I was always a freelancer in Afghanistan. Yeah, I was never really interested in representation through an agency. I was certainly never interested in like a staff job at a newsroom. But I did have, I was lucky enough to have reliable clients who were happy with me doing things my way. I'm a pretty slow photographer. I don't take a lot of pictures. I certainly don't turn around pictures very fast. I know I'm such a bad photojournalist. You know, I mean, you should be like uploading your pictures to the cloud as they are taken.
Oh yeah, yeah. Right. Like directly from a camera to computer. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's to not satellite. Me. But it was like, I spent so much time there and I had that sort of previous expertise about, you know, the nature of the American involvement in these wars that I felt like the reason people would hire me is because I had this sort of specific way of doing things and this specific argument that I was making about, you know, the theatrics of war, which was a very sort of central theme of, you know, these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere that, you know, were underpinned by, you know, the most absurd premise.
Right. Just to back up a little bit. During that time when you were enlisted and photographing, there was work of yours that would be put out there and published. And also you kept all the photos you made during that time as well, which would come to serve you later in Attention Service Member. But, you know, what was that experience like? Who were you showing it to?
Yeah. So the photographs I would take in Iraq, so, you know, figure like, I'm largely working alone. So I would, you know, go into General Petraeus's like big morning meeting in Baghdad, find out like what's going on where like the big sort of operations, where are the places where there's been a lot of activity, and then just get on a helicopter and explain to, you know, the lieutenant who's a platoon leader or something that like, I'm going to be riding with him for the next week. If he is really annoyed about that, he can take it up with General Petraeus. So then I would sort of file these stories from the field where I would send up the 10 pictures that were likely to see the light of day. So, you know, they sort of portrayed the, you know, occupation and, I mean, not necessarily a positive light, but like an effective light. So, you know,
like,
for example, covering like a hospital opening. So there are things like that that happened all the time in Iraq.
Right.
The U.S. gave them a bunch of money to build a hospital or refurbish one.
Yeah.
Completely ignoring the context that like there were no doctors.
Infrastructure, personnel. Right. Like, you might build a beautiful facility in the middle of nowhere that no one could get to. Right?
Yeah, exactly. you know, that was going to be taken over by... you know, a Shiite militia that would be using it as like a base to fire rockets at us from. But I didn't really know what I was doing in terms of like what I was supposed to, what was useful for, you know, the sort of military media machine and what was, you know, useful for the historical record, which is something I always thought about. But regardless, I didn't delete anything. And I saved all the photographs I took for the military on a hard drive. And I kept it organized. Kept it with me, you know, when I left the military. So like all the pictures on that drive, like I only ever sent up, you know, 1% of them.
Wow.
Because like I was the one doing the editing.
Right.
Yeah. So like all the outtakes, all the stuff that I knew wouldn't see the light of day was just on a hard drive in my closet for 10 years because I didn't think the pictures were very good or very useful. I just sort of created a portfolio out of what I thought were my best pictures, used that to get work in Afghanistan, and then immediately started making much stronger, more sort of sophisticated photojournalistic work from Afghanistan.
Was there a moment or an experience that you had where you got a sense of what was acceptable? Like what gave you that line? Like you were self-editing at a certain point when you're uploading, but so what gave you that line?
So, I mean, my first tour, like when I would send stuff up, I was sending it up to somebody I knew and worked with a lot who had one more tour than me and a couple more years in the army as me. And he would mentor me far as like, you know, what was like acceptable. I mean, I had, you know, quote unquote, technical skills beyond what most military photographers had because I'd been interested in photography for a while before that. Whereas, you know, I trained military photographers who said they picked that job because they thought it would be easy, you know, not because they were interested in photography. It's like, I'll see you on the battlefield.
That's the safe job.
Yeah, right. So that was part of it. But also, sometimes I would, you know, something would sort of slip through the cracks and get published and I would be like berated by colonel or, two-star general you know, learn that way. But I was always trying to push those boundaries because that's the nature of my personality, much to the chagrin of my superiors in the military. But yeah, what do you want? I'm from Boston. You know, you gotta fight for what's yours. I had an experience, you know, towards the end of my second tour in the army that really sort of cemented in my mind the idea that I had to get out. Like I couldn't reenlist. I had done what I set out to do and there wasn't any further I could push it. And that was spending several days in continuous combat west of Baghdad or west of Iskandaria, sorry. And coming back with a story that like represented like the drama and terror of, you know, this time. And it was just completely killed. Like some colonel was like, no, we're not going to run that. It was
so there were clear markers in the gears.
For sure. Yeah, it wasn't subtle.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's move ahead then you go to Afghanistan and then... At what point do you think I need to do some kind of book?
Yeah. So, I mean, working in Afghanistan, I was primarily working for digital news outlets. Mm-hmm. So this was like 2009 to like 2015, 16, when there was a real sort of boom in digital media, online only outlets. And now there are, you know, many of those outlets have collapsed, even like the biggest ones like BuzzFeed News is gone.
Yeah, Vice is I know.
Bankrupt. So, you know, even by 2016, I was really struggling with the ephemerality of the imagery that I had been making. Mm-hmm. You know, like I've been making this work that I feel like is important, that is, you know, sometimes like just the website breaks or the outlet goes under, and all this work that I've done is now just like completely inaccessible.
Yeah.
So that sort of experience like built up into this pathological need to create a physical object that presented the core arguments that I was trying to make about these wars and about American identity and America's, you know, fantasy of its own power in a durable physical object.
Had you already thought about, though, posting the work that had not made it, meaning the Attention Service Members is a combination of the photos you've wanted to show and the photos you were allowed to show, mm-hmm. right? And it is done in a way where sometimes we have this sort of very precise information and then we don't. And it's meant to be somewhat disorienting in that way. Mm-hmm. Did that all come through making the book, or was that something you were thinking about in terms of I need to show what it's like? And it was the fact that the media landscape was disappearing and you wanted that physical book, you know, like which came first, so to speak.
Certainly the concept of presenting work in this sort of inherently kaleidoscopic and disorienting way, mm-hmm. that came first. Mm. Because I felt like that is the central like experience of war. So, you know, I've always made work primarily for an American audience, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like the nature of the media ecosystem that I've worked for. So how do you explain the most sort of exotic experience for most of my audience who are, you know, like bicoastal liberal elites who, you know, consume a lot of news.
Yeah.
So how do I like bring that experience home? How do I put them in the helicopter? Because, you know, they're not going to be in the helicopter. Their mm-hmm. kids aren't. So the idea of presenting that work in that way is something I had developed or been working on for a few years prior to, you know, the books mm-hmm. taking shape. Because I've always found myself very frustrated with the limitations of journalism in terms of like the tools you have to tell a story and the amount of context that you have to place all your imagery in order for it to sort of qualify as journalism.
Yeah.
Well, in the information warfare environment of the global war on terror, context is so easily co-opted into lies. Mm-hmm. So having my work be, you know, I have the experience of having my work be used by like radical right wing and radical left wing organizations to prove opposite points.
Yeah.
Like the same work.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
That it was like, all right, how do I like reclaim a little bit of control mm-hmm. over how this stuff is used and, you know, what its function in society is.
Right. Yeah. You know, the book itself and I have to give credit. I have to give credit to some sources you sent me because of the nature of the way we're recording and the short booking time. Luke Mogelson is one of my sources, wrote a great article on the book. And also Jorg Kolberg, Conscientious Photography, CPM, Conscientious Photography Magazine. So they were really great sources for me. And I just want to give credit to that. And also all kinds of websites where I'm looking at images. But the book itself has this very boxy look. Cardboard boxy look. It looks like a package. It looks like some kind of a service kit or even like a ration kit or something like that. Like the whole aesthetic, right, is something you must have picked up from your time being enlisted, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the book itself is sort of the approximate dimensions of an MRE, which is
that's the acronym
for meal ready to eat.
Yeah.
Or those, you know, field rations.
The rations. Yeah.
The cardboard on the cover. I tested a bunch of different cardboards out like against the actual cardboard that they use for MREs mm-hmm. and use the closest one. It's meant to look like a field manual, like something yes. that could have been plausibly printed at like the base copy shop, mm-hmm. even though the binding is like, it's actually like a very
it's a
expensive,
real
yeah, it's a open spine binding with a right. silkscreen linen band. Yeah, it's
beyond field manual.
Oh
yes.
yeah. yeah, this is not just stapled with a bunch of brass clips. Yeah. but yeah. yeah, for it to have that like tactile, for people to engage with it in that sort of tactile way mm-hmm. was really important to me to, you know, communicate those experiences. I feel like, yeah, the kaleidoscopic, you know, devoid of context presentation of the pictures, like that's one aspect of it, sure. Mm-hmm. But considering the book as a physical object, you have so many options to, like, you know, deepen that experience yeah. for people. Like, you know, you're only printing 1500 of these. I mm-hmm. was paying for the whole thing myself. You know, there was nobody there to tell me I couldn't
that's right.
do this, or I needed to accept some default choice based on economics. So uh-huh. yeah, why not just push it as far as it can go conceptually?
Yeah. And it was published by Mass Books, we should mention. Yeah. Yeah.
So the first edition was actually published by Red Hook Editions.
Oh, Red Hook. Oh,
yeah.
And it
sold out largely because of Luke Mogelson's article.
Oh, okay.
And, the second edition is published by Mass Books, which is the okay. publishing house that Peter Van Ochtmail and I started.
Oh, okay. Okay. I didn't have that information. Thank yeah. you. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. But talking more about the book, so there's photos that are on, you know, good kind of, well, you tell me if I have this backwards, good kind of glossy, heavy paper. And then there's a thinner matte paper. Those, the matte paper, thinner images are the ones that were allowed to be published? Or do I have that backwards?
No, it's not quite like that. So I think there are five different paper stocks in Service Member.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. the book is constructed with, you know, the cardboard cover we talked about.
Right.
It's got these black and white pictures from home that are on this very sort of typical art photo book paper, you know, sort of satin finish, tritone, black and white with spot varnish. Very nice looking. and then the main body of the book is pictures from Iraq and Afghanistan, some officially released by the military, some not officially released by the military that I just had, and pictures that I made in Afghanistan as a civilian. Like, I did not differentiate in paper stock or presentation between those three sort of categories of image, because, like, for the casual viewer, it's unlikely that they would be able to tell, you know, mm-hmm. the difference. And that's okay. I didn't want to confuse the issue. And then there's another paper stock, which is 8,000 words of text. That's just an uncoated, you know, recycled paper. Okay. And then there's this like really crappy, like thin, glossy, like magazine stock.
Oh, okay.
That has these sort of ephemeral materials on it, you know, like the terrible food you eat in the military.
Oh, okay.
Field manual excerpts and things like that. But yeah, but it's about creating this cacophony of information mm-hmm. in this way that moves you through the book in a non-linear way, which is a struggle because like books are inherently read from left to right.
You left to right or right to left. Yes, yes.
Yeah, right. You flip a page, you go to the next page. Like that's how it works. But Kurt Vonnegut's book, Slaughterhouse-5, you know, he presented this idea of, you know, PTSD being defined by this chronic dislocation in time, you know, so the protagonist is moving involuntarily, time traveling. So I was like, how could I do this in a photo book? And so the idea is that like the pictures don't have any captions, but sometimes I write about the pictures. Mm-hmm. And so if you read the text, sometimes I'm referencing a picture you haven't seen yet. Sometimes I'm referencing a picture you've already seen. So you're moving around in this sort of like nonlinear way, like through the book.
And it is a very sort of journal diaristic layout of text, right? Like you're giving us events and experiences.
The text is super linear.
Yeah.
It's chronological. It's easy to follow.
Yeah.
Straight as an arrow.
And then there's
because there has to be like one sort of anchor point.
Right.
Yeah.
One thing that keeps you moving. Right. And then there are these really kind of beautiful illustrations. Where did those come from?
Those came from old military field manuals.
Oh, wow.
Which are all in the public domain. You know, you can use them for whatever.
Yep. Well, it belongs to the military, belongs to the people.
Yep. Absolutely. As are my photographs that were officially released through the military. The pictures that weren't officially released, I would say that's more of a gray area. They might not agree. And then the pictures from Afghanistan, I own the copyright
to. Right. Okay. So, and are those illustrations, were they meant to be instructive? Like, watch out for this plant, or this animal is indigenous to this place? Like, where did the, like, how did it line up with your text?
Yeah. I mean, I think like the images reflect some theme that's going on in the text. Like maybe I had mentioned grapes at one point. So there's just like a little illustration of grapes.
Or, right.
You know, the story about how I beat the urinalysis in Iraq, you know, using some medical equipment. So there's just like an image of some medical equipment.
Right.
But yeah, it's like, yeah, this is a scorpion.
Yeah.
If it looks like a scorpion, maybe stay away from it and don't like create scorpion fights with your fellow privates and bet on it.
Yeah. Yeah. We've been, you know, kind of sort of lighthearted about how it's all done and all, but this was like a very intense recuperative experience for you, maybe?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm just sort of used to talking about it in this sort of flip way, which is like, you know, just sort of who I am. But the book is very much rooted in pain and trauma and coming to terms with that. Coming to terms with my own, you know, complicity in the war, not just as a combatant, but also as like a purveyor of misinformation. So, yeah. And like that, the body keeps the score on all of that stuff. So it's like, how can one of the functions of the book be restorative, not just for me, but also as an entry point for people who lived the wars to help explain it to their loved ones?
Yeah. Have you gotten any kind of feedback like that?
Avalanche. An avalanche of feedback like that, which, you know, honestly is like everything about making the book hurt. You know, everything about it was hard. It was really stressful. Like, you know, I was quarterbacking a $32,000 production, having never done it before. You know, I'd made zines and things before, but it was so brutal. And I mean, after writing the 8,000 words of text, which took about 3 weeks working with a text editor, I mean, I was like catatonic for a few days. But once those sort of responses started coming in, that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, that made me feel good.
Yeah. And, you know, after you honorably discharged, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay. So after you're honorably discharged, you actually do complete your studies in photography using the, under the GI Bill, right? And you went to the University of Hartford?
I did, yes.
Or Hartford Art School, I'm not sure what it's called.
It's the University of Hartford, and then Hartford Art School is part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think I may be the only Iraq veteran to have, you know, squandered his GI Bill on an MFA in photography. But it was a really good program for me. I mean, A, it was limited residency, so I could keep working, which was necessary. And B, like, the program was really focused on the photo book.
Yeah.
So I really, you know, spent my time at Hartford learning the concrete skills necessary to, like, make the photo book I wanted to make.
There was a boom of photographers who came after the Vietnam War. I don't know how much of that was the GI Bill as well, but that would also, was sort of a response to the war. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great deal. I mean, I tell people all the, like, young people who are starting the careers, you know, are considering, you know, going $75,000 into debt for an MFA in photography. And it's like,
figure out another way.
Yeah. Why don't you join the Air Force? Like, you know, come on. It's no big deal.
Get some useful skills.
Yeah. Seriously. Yeah. We're not like at the height of an unwinnable war right now yet.
Well, not yet.
Yeah. Okay. So it is now like March 19th.
That's right. Let's mark the time and date.
Right. Yeah. Let me like 2 weeks.
That's right.
Yeah, I had a meeting this morning with the Ground Truth folks, and we're trying to you know, prepare for like the inevitable, you know, total global meltdown in the
what might be needed.
Yeah.
So we'll get to Ground Truth. That's that community local journalism idea organization. But then you actually basically you continue this work and the kind of the idea of this work. But in a more conceptual way with your second book, the follow-up book, 300 Meters, which is a Leporello, an accordion printed book, which makes so much sense for the photos, which were done with a spin shot camera.
Yeah, it's this SpinShot is this crazy toy camera mm-hmm. that was invented in the 90s by, I think, an LA Times photojournalist. You like pull a string yes. and then you let it go and the camera spins around like a 360. Well, right. It's more like a 412. This is not a precision instrument at all. I don't know. It spins around.
Right.
And one soldier, like when I was photographing with it in Afghanistan, thought I was like detonating a grenade.
I can imagine that would look like something you would throw after pulling the cord.
Soviet grenade. Yes, yeah, totally. Right. Some kind of IED. It was really like the fall of Afghanistan and the experience of trying to help my Afghan colleagues and friends mm-hmm. who, were so necessary to, helping me stay safe, so helping me find stories, helping me, get fed and transported, mm-hmm. All these things I relied on them so heavily for. And the Taliban were advancing on Kabul. Nobody knew whether or not, like, they were, going to follow sort of the ISIS playbook and just, like, murder everyone who had anything to do with, mm-hmm. The old Afghan government or the West. So, it was like 3 or 4 weeks of myself and several other journalists who are also veterans trying to, navigate people through the 300 meters of, incredibly like oceanic crowds around the airport in Kabul, trying to get out. And a couple of my colleagues did manage to get out, but more didn't. But so
the book is broken up with imagery that was 10 years earlier. And then this WhatsApp thread that you had with your friend and interpreter trying to get out.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like the pictures are of the opium poppy harvest mm-hmm. in 2011, which was very sort of central to the Taliban's like money machine.
The economy of Afghanistan. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And almost 10 years to the day, the Taliban's advance on Kabul and the, frantic and botched U.S. withdrawal. And, when a service member came out in 19, the war in Afghanistan has, really sort of simmered down to this like tense detente as far as like the U.S. was concerned. Like the Taliban and the Afghan army were still mm-hmm. fighting savagely, but like that was sort of beyond the scope of like the arguments I was trying to make. But during the fall of Kabul, I felt like, all right, so a service member needs an epilogue now, and I need some way of like honoring the my interpreters and friends and colleagues in Afghanistan. And it was also like, I think accordion books are cool. Mm-hmm. Like Joe Sacco's The Great War, Battle of the Somme over 36 hours represented in one continuous illustration made me feel like that was something I could do with this particular work. So yeah, it was a much sort of shorter process to make 300 meters mm-hmm. from dummy to book than service member. But I'm really happy with it. Now the global war on terror was 20 years long and almost exactly. And I feel like the books really cover the whole thing.
Well, did your friend and family get out?
No, my,
I know there are multiple people,
41 right. people, many of them were, from like five families and then some mm-hmm. younger people who are unaccompanied. Generally speaking, the younger people who are unaccompanied were able to get out. Mm. And the people who had their families with them or elderly people or were, physically compromised in some way, it was just impossible to navigate that tactical situation. And the State Department was in complete paralysis.
Absolutely.
At that time. I mean, they're still in complete paralysis.
I just remember the press conferences. They were, everybody was so useless.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, from, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of mm-hmm. Staff down to like anyone like working on the ground in the State Department.
Yeah. All those promises made. Some of the quotes that I read, we are inside, but others are not here. We left the area. We left out. I was close to the Americans. I mean, it's just panic. It's just.
Yeah. It was really gut wrenching to be, on the other side of the world mm-hmm. in the middle of the night, receiving these messages and trying to, coordinate, the multiple sources of intelligence that we had you know, information that our friends in Afghanistan did not have access to, like real-time satellite imagery and things like that, that, you know, we, if you've worked in Afghanistan for 7 years, it's like, yeah, you're going to know like scary Delta Force operators and spies and mercenaries and like, you're going to have access to stuff. And yeah, trying to utilize that information effectively in real time was, yeah, it was really brutal. But yeah, I mean, that is, that WhatsApp thread is from, you know, the last sort of frantic attempt at the gate. And yeah, so that's my colleague saying that he got into the airport, but nobody else was with him. And so he felt like he had to leave. It was like too scary to be in this sort of demilitarized zone. Like,
yeah. The I also read it was the event itself was referred to as the Digital Dunkirk. Who wrote that? Do you remember?
I want to say that was in Foreign Policy.
Oh, okay.
I think it was like a Foreign Policy think piece. And it was, you know, one of us who, you know, was a veteran who worked in Afghanistan. It was like trying to help some people and just decided to give an interview to a reporter articulating all our tactics, techniques, and procedures, which could then be exploited by the Taliban to like thwart our operations. But, you know, I think the Digital Dunkirk, like as a moniker would have been more apt if like there had been a lot of fog on the English Channel and all the boats had crashed into each other and most of them had sunk.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Dunkirk was a successful operation.
Dunkirk was known as a successful operation of evacuation. That. So I'm not sure.
I mean, a lot of people got out.
It's true.
But it was the people who, you know, managed to get into the airport.
That's
it had nothing to do with like who worked with the Americans,
there was no great intelligent operation
it's just like the first 80,000 people who managed to scramble into the airport got out.
Yeah.
And now they're in Kansas for better or for worse, or more likely in a refugee camp in Doha. And you know, my friends who are still in Afghanistan are actually glad. I mean, they would take the opportunity to go to America in a heartbeat, but they know so many people who are stuck in Romania or stuck in Doha that they would much rather be in Afghanistan than some refugee camp in Romania.
And in some ways, you're continuing this kind of mission to, you know, affect journalism and how journalism is conducted in conflict zones. But even more in general, with the Ground Truth Project, and you're the director of photography for the Ground Truth Project, which houses Report for America, and this is all, you know, promoting and participating in this idea of local and community journalism as a source for more accurate or more representative information, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Report for America is a national service organization. We have more than 300 early career reporters working in journalism, local journalism, all across the U.S. and Puerto Rico and Guam. And I work with the photographers. And so a big thing, like photojournalism, particularly local photojournalism, has been gutted like an order of magnitude worse.
Oh, no. Unbelievable.
Than, you know, writing or audio or video.
You might as well just publish Google Earth images at this point.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people do. Like resources. A lot of outlets do.
They
publish stock photography. But, you know, I really believe, and, you know, the data backs me up, that quality local photojournalism representing communities fairly in, you know, a way that they can get behind drives engagement. And regardless of, you know, what we think about like the utility of journalism in terms of like its necessity for democracy, we live in a capitalist society and our economy is attention driven. So we're in an attention economy. Like, how do you deal with that? And so, yeah, I work with early career photojournalists who have, you know, been told largely through their, you know, antiquated J school programs that, you know, you got to just like waggle your 28 millimeter at news moments and push the button and then you'll be a great photojournalist. And it's like, no. I mean, you have so much more responsibility now as a photographer, like, you know, engaging audiences in clever ways like is on you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the earlier in your career, you can sort of figure that out, like, you know, how do you communicate in an interesting, like, honest way that will really engage people and bring them into this sort of shared conversation is the only path forward. So yeah, that's sort of where my work falls, like, in, you know, my capacity as a photo director.
Yeah. And what's the sort of logistics of it? Like, is there a home-based building or is everybody spread out everywhere?
Everybody's spread out everywhere. Yeah. I mean, we've had photographers in Alaska. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And most of our photographers are the only visual professional in their, like, small newsroom. Yeah. So to that end, you know, I really try to create community between the photographers by having bi-weekly meetings that turn into these, like, 4-hour knockdown, drag out critiques in the middle of the night. You know, we have special guests from, you know, the highest echelons of photojournalism. And also just like, you know, we'll have a literary journalist join us. So, you know,
that's great.
You know, videographers to sort of present many different ways, like sort of career trajectory stories, because it's good to see people, like, when you're young, see people, how did you get to where you are?
Because
it's all in these individual paths. There's no sort of pipeline anymore. And also just to, like, acculturate often very isolated photographers into, you know, the sort of language and culture of, you know, modern photography.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, give that sense that you're part of something bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because it is, like, it's a small community, it's a tight community, but it's also, like, really insular and it can be hard to sort of break into it.
Absolutely.
So that's definitely a priority of mine as well. And yeah, increasingly I've been working with Report for the World, which is one of our sort of sister organizations that's supporting local journalism all over the world.
Oh, that's fantastic. And so tell me more about your publishing house.
Yeah, so Mass Books is a little publishing house. I guess it's technically based where I live in Western Massachusetts. But Peter Van Ogtmail and I started it at a time when we each had our own books coming out and we just sort of needed, like, we were self-publishing them and we just kind of needed a label to put on them. So we started Mass Books. So his book, Sorry for the War, came out. My second edition of Service Member came out. And you know, they were both really successful. And then, so people started reaching out to us like, hey, I want to publish a book with Mass Books. It's like, oh my God, here we go. But then my friend Gabrielle Angotti Jones came to us with a project that I had been watching evolve for a couple of years, photographing the Black girl surfer community and her experience, like, sort of growing up in the surfing world and sort of the intersection of, I mean, really, like, depression and, you know, this unbelievably joyous activity, you know, the most, like, sort of rubber meets the road, like, you know, experience of wilderness that, you know, you can be, like, being in a wave. And nice. So that became our first sort of outside author book, I Just Want to Surf, which was shortlisted for Aperture Perry Photo.
Oh, and I forgot to mention, so was your book, Attention Service Member.
Yeah, I was really psyched about that.
Yeah.
And we just released another book called What Should I Be by Jacqueline Silberbush. That's an amazing book. And it's actually a project that I first became aware of here at Chico. In 22, Jackie showed me that work and was saying, like, I found it incredibly moving and was like, nobody wants to publish this. Oh my God, what am I going to, I was like, I'll publish this immediately.
That's great. I now have that book because of Chico, because of Charcoal Book Club.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It is fantastic.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Well, that's great. That's a nice place to end, full circle.
Totally.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you as well.
Yeah. This is great. All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Photo Work with Sasha Wolf is a production of the Photo Work Foundation. Executive producer is Sasha Wolf, and the associate producer is Taylor Selsback. The show is also produced and edited by me, Michael Chauvin-Dalton of Real Photo Show. Music is by J. Walter Hawks. If you like the show and wish to find out more about the foundation, please visit photowork.foundation and be sure to subscribe and review with all the stars on your listening platform.